It's one of two huge episodes to celebrate the release of the Pylon box set. Michael Lachowski is on the show today, guitar player of the band, and more on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnitupunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Tristan, thank you for all the hard work you do for the show. I love you, buddy. He also runs the Facebook page and the Instagram page, and he can get messages to me. So check out those things, too, on Facebook and Instagram, at Turned Out a Punk. If you want to get in touch with me more directly, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, at Left for Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling all your friends about it, letting everyone know that you enjoy this podcast that we do here each and every week. You can also subscribe to it and rate it on iTunes. Thank you to the people that do. You can also head over to patreon.com and check out Turned Out a Punk footnotes that we do over there on that platform and other stuff. And thank you, thank you, thank you to all the people that do that. I really cannot thank you enough for helping me keep the lights on. And speaking of helping me keep the lights on, thank you very much to the fine folks at Vans who came aboard a few years ago and have helped me cover the costs of doing this thing. And I really appreciate it. I really appreciate them, yeah, thank you for them. You know, just a little podcast. And here they are saying, you know what, we'll help you cover some of the costs on this thing. And I appreciate that. Thank you very much, Vans. And that is that. On to today's show. Today on the show, it's one of two episodes in celebration of this brand new Pylon box set. My friend Brady Brock over there at New West Records hit me up and said, would you want to do something with Pylon? And I was like, oh my gosh, absolutely. Because this is a band that, you know, I think depending on where you kind of came to them, you have a very different relationship to them. You know, like there's a lot of people that got into them after the reissue that came out a few years ago on DFA Records. You know, there's a lot of people that got into them back in the day and they have, you know, relationships to the scene or how they heard them and things like that. For me, I discovered Pylon just by going to used record stores, and I discovered them kind of completely out of context, you know, just found these records by this band that looked really interesting, brought them home, and immediately was taken by this band's sound. And I'll get into it a lot more on the next episode when we have Vanessa. Spoiler, Vanessa's going to be on the next episode from Pylon. But the vocals were something that really struck me, her approach to that. And then, of course, the guitars, the music, they're catchy. It's arty. It's aggressive and abrasive. And yeah, so they are a big band for me on my personal journey through this thing. So thank you to Brady for making this happen, because I got to ask all the questions I had, you know, kind of in the back of my mind for all these years and about their relationships, different scenes. And oh, these are two very different episodes. So I don't think you're going to have to worry about too much redundancy between, you know, this one and Vanessa's episode. Because, you know, Michael and her are talking about completely different subjects. And I love doing these ones where you get two people from the same band talking about their experiences with the band, because it's amazing how different people experience different things differently. You know, that sounds very obvious, but I don't know. I find it is very much, you know, in the forefront when I do these two people from the same band, or three people from the same band, or people from the same scenes even, you know. It's I love doing this podcast sometimes, and these are those kinds of weeks. Sorry this one was delayed. I did have to deal with some technical kind of stuff on the computer side of things, but hey, we made it happen. I'm not going to yammer on anymore. Check out this box set, also designed by Henry Owings of Chunklet fame. And if you are a fan of fanzines or magazines that are punk in origin, you are definitely a fan of Chunklet, because it is one of the best of all time. All time. I was going through some back issues actually recently, filing some stuff away. So Henry designed this thing. It looks beautiful. It weighs a ton from what I hear. I haven't actually held it in my hands yet, but everyone I've talked to that has said, oh my gosh, is this a heavy duty thing? Okay, well, I am done. I want you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Michael Lachowski on Turned Out a Punk. Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here and appreciate your interest.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I'm a bit of a record nerd. And over the years in my nerdy pursuits, kind of discovered Pylon kind of early into the journey. And, you know, your band's obviously a massive influence on a lot of people, myself included. And so, yeah, it's an honor to have you here. And I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Michael, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yeah, I think so. I really do think that it was the Vibrators album. And it's kind of weird in that album was the thing that Randy and I maybe first sort of just attached ourselves to, that we kind of identified as punk. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could argue as to how, you know, authentic they were or something like that. I don't know. And the reason I even say that is that over the years, I think Randy was more inclined to mention that group than I was. Like, because, you know, I feel like my taste accelerated, you know, more, you know, fairly quickly expanded, I should say, into some other groups that over time have maybe held up better, not just for me, but like for the culture in general, because I really don't ever hear anybody reference the Vibrators. And, you know, but I remember it was easy, you know, it was easy to access because it was a little bit, you know, sort of pop in some ways. And I remember playing it for like one of my best friends. So like in my art school friends and, you know, Randy, who was my roommate, everybody would be just like, yeah, whatever. But I played it for one of my super close personal friend from really like the year before. And he was like kind of shocked that I was listening to that. And he was like, Michael, that is punk. And I was like, what? What's wrong with that? You know, it was almost like it was transgressive just by going like outside of my art school circle and bringing this up with a friend of mine who was like basically pre-med biochemistry major. And, you know, so just by chance, I think maybe Apple Music recommended it to me or whatever, but there was I think a 2012 or 13 album by the Vibrators. And I just happened to listen to it last week. And they have I didn't really investigate this that much. I don't remember anything about that band or the people in it, but I did notice that they had brought in some different guest people on this newer album, and they re-recorded, I think, a couple of their like bigger hits from the album I was familiar with. I have no idea if their albums in between. Anyway, it's just kind of funny to think back on that band because, yeah, that was probably the first so-called punk band. Just like my first so-called like rap album was The Sequence.
I love the Vibrators, you know. And was it Pure Mania, like the one with the big V on the cover, or was it V2?
Yeah.
Oh, Pure Mania.
Yeah, no, Pure Mania. Mm-hmm.
That record's fantastic. Like, I know what you're saying because I think there's, you know, kind of a rub on them that they might have been like more of a pub rock band that kind of like shifted over or something like that. But I don't know. I saw them live. It must have been like 96, 97. And they were great. They kind of stole the show. It was a bunch of like older punk bands getting back together. And they were one of the better bands on the bill.
I don't know. I mean, these days, like when I go back and listen, like the first Stranglers album, you know, to me, that's a little bit more, it just sounds a little bit more like they meant it, you know, and, you know, because even the Sex Pistols, I always kind of, as much as I still prefer that album to a whole lot of other albums, I can never really shake the feeling that it was a little bit of a manufactured type band, so yeah, it was really good, but I always felt a little, you know, less genuine. And so I don't know. I don't know that I really listened to a lot of stuff that was straight up punk, though. I mean, the Stranglers, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I think I was really into music that just had a few other things going on in it, like Killing Joke and, you know, stuff that was sort of challenging and industrial, like DNA and things like that.
Absolutely.
Lydia Lunch, like that No New York compilation album was made had a outsized influence on me and Randy, just because it was one of the few records that we had that contained some of those groups. I mean, plus we did buy a lot of singles, and just because they are in a box somewhere, I don't think about them as often as I do the vinyl. We had some influences from a fair number of bands, some of which have sort of gone away from, again, just away from being remembered that much, like Prag Vec, but yeah, so I had Strangler singles, I think, before I had Strangler albums, and Gang of Four singles before Gang of Four albums and stuff like that during that period.
Well, that's the thing that's amazing about kind of like punk rock is because, obviously it gets taken up very much in a kind of like a postcard way or like a coffee table book kind of way. But the reality was like it kicked open the door for just so much stuff that just kind of like from Killing Joke to, Side Effects to like, DNA and Lydia Lunch to like, yourselves. Like I really feel like, punk, especially on this show, Lydia Lunch has been a guest, of course. Like it's very much like the broad term. Like it's just kind of anything that kind of gets assumed by that energy almost.
Yeah, and I just a couple of years ago, I finally got around to reading the book that was compiled, The Oral History of Punk Rock. Please Kill Me, I think was the
Yes,
name of it. And
very controversial book.
yeah, but just in terms of like how it kind of lists the band, so to speak, just kind of a review of certain bands of a certain time and place, and plus in England too, I guess. But it was just kind of brought me back to the which of those bands was I really paying attention to. And out of the ones in that oral history, I would say it was mostly the Ramones and Television. I mean, I just love the Television stuff, but again, I don't, it sounded like punk to me at the time, but now that I listen to it, I think about it being more as like Tom Verlaine as a poet or something, and the guitar, intertwined guitars and all that stuff. So I still enjoy it, but it doesn't, I don't know how punk it feels.
It probably feels very different now because we're onto the whatever generation of bands that have been influenced by Television. So it's become kind of just part of the musical lexicon. But at the time, I imagine it would have been a lot more kind of shocking to hear, someone singing kind of off key like that deliberately. And as you're saying, like the weird interplay with guitars, like that is something that, wasn't echoed in Genesis or wasn't echoed in Queen or in a lot of other stuff that was happening on kind of a more sort of mainstream level at the time.
Yeah, I know, 'cause I did. I just totally ignored, whatever the mainstream stuff was. And two or 3 weeks ago, when Eddie Van Halen died, I realized like I'm really not that much. I could probably even have named one song, except for maybe I would have remembered that they did Jump, and that was about it. And I went, and so I started listening to some best hits or whatever, and I was just, I couldn't listen to it. I just couldn't. I just didn't think it was interesting at all. The song structures and stuff just seemed so slapdash, and with a, I just didn't get it. So yeah, I don't feel I didn't really understand what was going on out on that other side of rock music at all. I just never paid attention at all.
Well, what were you into prior to the vibrators? Like, what kind of stuff were you, a fan of as a younger person?
Well, I was sort of a, for people in my circle or people that I knew and in my family and all that stuff, I was pretty much the only person that really cared about music in my grade school and my high school. And I don't know where I got the passion for it. I think it was just that for me, it was culturally the most, just the most exciting, most important thing to me. I did read a lot of novels, and I of course watched TV like every other suburban American kid. And especially when I got to college, you know, I got caught up on watching a lot of films. But really, by the time I was getting into college, I was starting to get really lost. I was just losing, like, I didn't know what I was supposed to be listening to anymore. It all, I was finding myself buying, like, you know, the fifth album by some bands or whatever, and just like, nah, you know, I was just like, you know, the fourth or fifth album by Jethro Tull or whatever. And I was like, God, I'm just not feeling it. And so somewhere I missed out on some information because the way I was getting my information wasn't very sophisticated or thorough. I didn't have anybody that was mentoring me in music. I don't really remember, you know, like even like I would maybe read Rolling Stone or something, but or the Great Speckled Bird out of Atlanta, I think was the name of it. But I don't, I just didn't have that much guidance. And then the one thing that I did have that I maybe it didn't influence what I purchased as much as, but another way for me to listen to music is that I was kind of in the early days of non-commercial FM radio stations out of college stations. And so being in the Atlanta area, I did start listening to WREK from Georgia Tech. And then a little later than that, I think, the one started up from Georgia State University. They, I don't remember their call letters because they basically promoted it as 88.1 or whatever the number was. And but anyway, I was kind of lost. I was almost like starting to listen to jazz and trying to figure out, you know, music that was maybe more sophisticated and interesting. But of the things that I still sort of care for that I was listening to as I approached college and stuff was like probably Frank Zappa. And for some reason, I just got deep into this solo albums by George Harrison, partly just because of that kind of sort of philosophy that's embedded in those. And so I got rescued a little ways into college, but I was completely missing out on, and maybe wouldn't have even liked it, but on stuff like the Velvet Underground and you know, the and Johnny Thunders and stuff like that, and other things that might have primed me a little bit more for what I got into eventually. I just bought a, but I bought records and I listened to a lot of music, and then I would save up my money and then buy like an 8-track recorder, and then I would record all my. I wouldn't buy pre-recorded tape because I knew that the quality of those was crap. I just, you know, read Stereo Review magazine and all this stuff when I was in high school, and so. But I got an 8-track portable player, you know, one of the ones that had batteries on one half and the player, and then on the other side was just a speaker, and you could separate them up to 6 feet or so. And so I recorded all my a lot of my vinyl onto 8-track, and then I took the 8-track records with me, 8-track tapes with me, and the player to high school, and I played in the classroom, and I played out on the front yard, and all this stuff. So I was always the one that had music, and you know, had the wherewithal to bring it along. And became sort of the de facto DJ in a lot of social environments, different ones. And that carried over pretty much on into art school and being in the band. And even after that, I did become a DJ for real, you know, locally.
How aware were you of the sort of Sex Pistols show that happened in Atlanta? Like, did that make local news at the time?
Yeah, I mean, because it was making national news. I
Yeah, that's true.
mean, yeah, definitely. That actually is part of what fed into my lack of interest in them. Like all of the hype, you know, and all the alarm, all the hyperbole or whatever about it, was just it just seems so crazy and ridiculous. It's, I mean, like. There was some show, what was his name? There was some show where everything on it was just like asinine and kind of over the top. Like maybe it was, is it Jerry Springer? I think that's it. Some TV show where everything was just about like, you know, absurd, you know, people yelling or I don't know what. And that's the way I felt about the Sex Pistols whole shtick, you know, and it wasn't necessarily their fault, but just, but of course, you know, McLaurin was probably like pleased as punch that they were getting that kind of publicity. And it was to me just a complete turn off. I felt like because of the publicity to go to that show would just be just so obvious and so dumb because you'd be surrounded by all these people that were kind of there for the wrong reasons. So I had no interest in going and I was a little bit surprised like how many of my more sophisticated friends, they did go. I mean, they actually took it seriously and they went. And I guess they just went because they knew it was sort of a, maybe they didn't mind that it was a media circus, but it turned me off. And so it wasn't until sort of after the fact, like after they broke up, that I was willing to actually, you know, listen to their, buy their album and listen to it. And then I fell in love with the album. So yeah, I did not care and I didn't care that I missed it.
So were you seeing any bands that were kind of playing locally at this time? Like were there, you know, local bands that would be opening these shows or you'd see, you know, smaller shows that would be happening around where you were back then?
No, live music for me was more like national recording acts at that level. You know, I was like, you had to go back to when I was like 14 or whatever, but I was like really into Alice Cooper. So I think it's 14 or 15. I got my parents to drop me off at an Alice Cooper concert and pick me up afterwards. And then I saw them again. And I went to a lot of shows in Atlanta. I mean, I lived on the outskirts of the metro, like really suburbs. They did eventually build a perimeter around Atlanta, and I lived on, just on the outside of the perimeter. So it's not like I lived in town. But I would go all the way downtown to go to shows at the Atlanta Municipal Auditorium and saw like Pink Floyd and Yes opened up for them and saw Spirit and Blood Rock and well I really only like that one album, you know, the 12 Dreams album, because I've tried listening to their other stuff and I just am less interested in the rest of it. It's just sad. But so I did go see kind of a lot of bands for somebody without a lot of money. And you know, then I saw some bands like at the Omni, and I'm trying to remember like what now. I saw Led Zeppelin, you know, at the Atlanta Fulton County Stadium outdoors and that kind of thing. But now I don't think I had access to any or I don't have much recall of anything that was live. And that was local, that was live. And if I did, it didn't make much of an impression on me because I mean, maybe I did, and I just don't even remember. And then when I got to college, I would go see stuff like Tom Waits and things like that. You know, what's the guy's name in Atlanta? The Aquarium.
I don't know.
Society. Bruce Hampton. Okay. And things like that. You know, acts like that would come to the university, and I would usually go see them. They were free and. But still the programming, you know, wasn't, you know, it was worth going to see, but it wasn't necessarily what I would have bought tickets to and driven to another city to see it, but it was right here on campus. I don't really know that live music was that much of a thing for me. My music experience was through vinyl, and that's one of the reasons that our little scene in Athens, like with the B-52s performing in somebody's kitchen, it was like smack right there in your space, right? Right. You know, we had so many house parties and everything. And then those house parties just were transformed by the fact that now we're like sticking live, you know, live music right into the middle of these smallish spaces like somebody's kitchen or living room. And it just felt so exciting, you know? And I don't think we really ever went to see anything live in town because, like, there was this one place called The Last Resort. And I think the sign said, what would it have been? It had three things. It was like folk, blues, and whatever the third thing like that would be. I can't remember what the third category
Was
was.
it bluegrass, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, something like that. And then there were, there were like big giant beer hall type places with cover bands. I mean, it's not like I never went to those, but I went to those once or twice as a freshman, maybe just because you're supposed to go check it out, and it just wasn't that interesting at all.
Yeah, totally.
So I was, and then so when I really did start having live music, it was in my friends' houses, and then soon after that, and my friends were the people performing. It was a very intimate scene for a really long time. I mean, it was a real tight knit scene of a pretty large number of people, but everybody was always there almost. We were just all this sort of this big family kind of on a party train.
So, how long after the Sex Pistols show in Atlanta would these B-52 shows have taken place?
Gosh, I don't know, maybe almost a year. I don't really remember though. Somewhere in that 6 months to 14 months. I don't really know.
So, would they have been, I guess, the first sort of punk band, new music band kind of going in the area back then?
Yeah, I suppose so, because they maybe over in Atlanta the fans were already together, and I don't know if I ever saw them, if I saw them before or after the B-52s. And then also Tom Gray had the Brains in Atlanta. So they kind of famously wrote Money Changes Everything, and that got covered later on. And then in Athens, the B-52s, really, other than them, the only other thing, and it was who we opened for our first show, was a band called the Tone Tones. But I think they formed after the B-52s, and all of them were good musicians, but they just, maybe the concept or the personalities or something didn't gel. I don't really know what happened. But so that broke up, but it did ended up. It ended up producing the Method Actors, because two of the members of the Tone Tones became the Method Actors, and the Method Actors recorded and toured and stuff around the same time that Pylon was active. So, in the sequence of bands, as far as the way we remember it now, and this may not be entirely accurate, but it was the B-52s, and then the Tone Tones, and then Pylon, and the B-52s had moved away by then, and the Tone Tones broke up. So initially, I mean, at least for a brief period of time, Pylon, might have been it, and until like maybe then the Side Effects were formed and OOK and stuff like that. So it wasn't stuff was happening pretty quickly, Pylon played their first show in February of 79, and then we played in New York City for the first time in August of 79. And then we were back up in New York City a month later, and on and on and on. It just like it really went at a pretty fast clip.
So was that Raz recording that's on the box set recorded before you guys played your first show?
No, we had already been playing for a good while, but it was recorded before we went into a proper studio, with the intention of recording a single to be put out on DB Records, which wasn't until, I guess, maybe the end of 79 that we recorded it, but it wasn't released until 1980, and that was Cool and Dub.
Okay.
But so the Raz tape was recorded, and I just need to ask him what month. I don't know. it was recorded, you know, sometime probably in the fall of 79, because just based on some of our earlier songs that we ended up getting rid of from the set, just from the repertoire really, are on there. But then Kool and Dub are both on there, and they were extremely new when we recorded them for DB records, so especially Dub. So it must have been recorded like right around the same time that we did end up going into the studio to record a single.
So, how long was the scene kind of revolving around these house shows? Like, did it eventually move into clubs, I would imagine, at some point, but you know, like, were you guys still playing these shows in these houses?
It was based around house shows actually for a pretty good while because the B-52s, like for instance, that place I mentioned that played blues, folk, and bluegrass, let's say. Oh, maybe it was jazz. I don't remember. That could have been up there on the marquee on their sign, basically. But the B-52s did manage to play there and also at the university before they moved out of town. But for us, no, we were just playing at parties and there was this other place in town called Tyrone's O period C period, just terrible naming convention. And I guess they had programming a little bit like the Last Resort, but maybe a little more rock oriented or something. And you know, whatever the bands were, some of them were local, I think. And I remember like the sound man at that place. He used to kind of bitch that our scene just got so hot and so big and so well regarded so quickly. And he's like, "Oh, people been making music in this town for years. It's always been a good music town and all this stuff." But I'm still at a complete loss to even like think of the name of one band that he, you know, of whatever that scene was that somewhat preceded us. You know, we went to that club and wanted to play there and ask, and they said, you know, they just didn't have any interest in this like new music scene. Like it had a bad reputation or something, probably because of the national press about some, you know, that one thing with the Sex Pistols or something. But so we somehow got them to give us like a Tuesday night, and we told them, we said, you know, a lot of people are going to come if you let us play. And they're like, "Well, we'll give you a Tuesday night." So we played, and I think 200 people showed up, and they were just, you know, amazed. And after that, they said, "You can play any Friday or any Saturday you want." And so our scene essentially like just took over that club. It became like the place where everyone played, and REM played, and they finally got with the program. They started bringing over bands from elsewhere. Gang of Four and XTC both played there. But one February or winter, when there was snow on the ground, the place caught on fire and burnt down. So then that necessitated and helped sort of precipitate other changes, you know, which venues, because by then the scene was undeniable. You know, the 40 Watt Club had opened up as a in another smaller space and all this stuff. So, but up until we kind of cracked that open, yeah, there were quite a few house shows, quite a while.
One of the things I find most fascinating about punk is like where it took hold. Like from what you're describing prior to your bands and your wave and generation, there wasn't much going on in Athens in terms of music at the time. And then here it is, it just explodes, you know, in this city of all places.
I know because like we were interviewed like so often. We were always like getting interviewed by the local weekly or when we were touring and radio station, you know, college stations. And I mean, we it seemed I guess there I don't know I guess there were I don't know if there were more print outlets or if it's just the local weeklies and stuff. But anyway, People were always very curious about, you know, Athens, like why Athens and all that. And I mean, I always kind of downplayed it because my thinking was like, Athens better not get too full of itself because I mean, this is just the result of like young people being in a college town. It is that because I feel like I remember being told like, oh yeah, there's like similar or very cool scenes like in Lawrence, Kansas, and here and there, you know, Austin, whatever. And so I didn't want Athens to like pretend that it had anything, that it had the market cornered on being original. I kept just thinking it was a matter of, you know, when that all these other scenes were going to emerge and stuff. And, you know, I really don't know how that turned out because like Athens has managed to maintain, I mean, not just from that period, and but it has managed to sort of maintain a reputation. And I think it's somewhat deserved. You know, one big benefit though to Athens having such a huge reputation that has maybe persisted is that REM chose to stay in Athens, stay put, and then also just got like hugely famous and influential. And that went a long way to really giving Athens like the opportunity to build up a real, some real depth of like people that wanted to live here, wanted to stay here, wanted to move here in order to make music, but also in terms of the other infrastructure aside from clubs, like, having a magazine and then recording studios and having, you know, those people on the scene that are in these various, roles that, they're often overlooked and unsung, but they're the people that just because they're not on stage that are just as important, you know, and do a lot of the work. And it's gotten more and more like that in Athens now that there's a place that's named after a young musician. In his memory, his family started a facility in Athens named after him. His name was Nucci Phillips, and he they created a place to help people like him who was a musician and had mental health problems. And that place has just become so influential. They have like a summer camp for 13 to 17 year olds or something like that, and that train people, you know, being a rock band and all this stuff with really good instructors. And, you know, there's just so many things that are contributing. The University of Georgia's business school has a music business program, like a certificate level program that anybody at the university, I think, can take. And it's being taught by David Barbie. He used to run and still is partner in one of the major recording studios here, but was in the band Mercy Land and some other bands. And David Lowry from Cracker and now Andrew Rieger from Elf Power all teach there. And it's just, you know, great. We've got Kindercore vinyl record pressing plant in Athens that opened up about 3 years ago that's pressing all of these records for our box and the reissue of Gyrate and Chomp. So Athens is like really held it together.
It's amazing how much, you know, just geographically even, this punk scene that your bands were a part of, and obviously everything that kind of came out of it, you know, the Pylon kicks off, it changed Athens profoundly.
Yeah, you know, but it's still a product of its time and some other dynamics. I didn't even have an appreciation for certain dynamics that had happened at the University of Georgia before I arrived here that I think had a huge influence on all of us at the art school, especially apparently there was like a desire on the part of the governor or somebody in the state government that we really needed they wanted to invest money and be very, you know, deliberate about building up the University of Georgia. So there was a bunch of new hires, and a bunch of these people got hired four, six, 8 or so years before my group comes waltzing in. And as a result, the art department, which was already pretty big and significant, especially in the whole of the Southeast, but I mean, it's pretty big and very early art department, for the United States and at a state university. But anyway, that had started back in the 50s, but a little bit before I came here, they were getting all these younger, much more, like, I don't know, liberal professors from other parts of the country, like hiring them from New England and wherever. And so there was a lot of energy already kind of churning, and just our era, we managed to escape being drafted in the Vietnam War, and there was just a lot of different factors that kind of supported what we were all doing. I think it made it pretty easy. I don't know if it made it, a guarantee that we were going to be interesting and creative, but it was definitely a kind of fertile ground for us, especially laid over this like fairly dull, state of the city of Athens and stuff like that. I mean, it was the university, and that was about it. So by going off of the university and moving out of dorms and living in all these in-town neighborhoods that at the time were sort of being abandoned for the suburbs, just like the downtown merchants were sort of leaving downtown for the mall and strip malls and stuff. So we kind of had the infrastructure of Athens like kind of to ourselves for quite a while.
How did the relationship with DB Records come about? Because I think, you're the, or Kool Dub, I should say, is the second or maybe it's the third release on the label.
It's somewhere like that, yeah, like the second or third. Well, Danny Beard and a partner, Harry, I don't remember Harry's last name, opened up this basically a used record store in Atlanta, and it is still there, same location, same concept, still very popular all these years later. And he just was close enough to the people that were doing interesting things, like the people in the fans that lived over in Atlanta. So I don't remember how he got connected to the B-52s. I've heard the story, I just don't remember it. Like he might have been up in New York for a fan show, or went up to see the B-52s play that first show up there or something. I don't remember all of that, but as far as those of us in Athens were, like, at least me, I was really aware of it. It mostly happened after he put out the record by the B-52s. And we got to meet him and everything. And I think Vanessa will remember the details way better than me. But yeah, he was sort of learning how to run a record label on the fly, the same way as the way we were learning how to make music on the fly. We didn't really know how to be a band or anything either, but that wasn't a big priority for us. It was it just something that just kind of kept evolving. It was almost like as the carpet was being rolled out in front of us, we were like, well, we might as well walk on it kind of thing. Like we weren't really pushing for any of this stuff, but like if offers are made, like, hey, would you like to record a single, we'd be like, oh yeah, that'd be great, so we just kind of just sort of followed along. So yeah, he gave us a lot of freedom, and but I mean, we didn't have very much money invested in these projects, so our approach to how to record wasn't very wasn't very deluxe. We had to make a lot of decisions as we went along. Like we'd record a song and go like, oh no, I think we can do that better. Can we do that again? And they'd say, well, do you want to record over the one you just did? And we're like, oh, no, maybe not. Can we keep two of them? And they'd be like, you know, at the beginning of the recording session, they'd be like, sure. But like by the middle of the recording session, well, you're going to have to decide because we can't keep two of everything because we don't have enough tape. So, you know, it was always risky as to whether or not you were going to be able to do it, play it again better. You know, and we would record like an entire album and then mix it, you know, in whatever, 3-4 days, something like that. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's probably for the best because people get very tempted to start tinkering way too much when they go into recording studios. And I was like, I don't like live albums, but I did like our band live, and I didn't want our band to be augmented with a bunch of extra parts and filler and filigree and all that.
I also wanted to talk to you about going to New York for the first time. It was that first show that you played there that I think, according to legend, like the B-52s like helped you get the show or something like that.
Yeah. Well, they made a recommendation to the bookers at Hurrah, the club Hurrah.
Okay.
And the woman who had initially booked it, she was, you know, she had a very untimely death.
Oh my God.
And was struck by a taxi in New York and died from it.
Wow, that's horrible.
We ended up getting a call a little later, weeks or so, you know, after all of that kind of settled out for them. And Jim Ferrat had, I think, taken over the booking. And he said that he was going by the commitments that she had made, and he was wanting to follow up with us. And so I think what happened is that I talked to him and he said, so we want you guys to, you know, we have you come, we go ahead and come up here and you can open for somebody. So I remember him just saying, like, I've got like two different slots, you know, and one of them was something along the lines of Lena Lovitch, but maybe not necessarily Lena Lovitch. I'm not real sure. And then the other one was Gang of Four. And then it was like, yes, please, we'll take the Gang of Four slot. You know, I tried to say that without sounding too excited because that was like the most amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
And so that's how we got our first show up there. And then after getting booked there, it was pretty easy to just ask a club in Philly and the Rat in Boston. At Philly, it was the Hot Club, and just, you know, Pylon has already gotten booked by Hurrah. They're opening for the Gang of Four, such and such a date. Are you interested in booking them? And it was like, yes, you know, it was just super easy. In fact, we ended up, the Hot Club had already booked an opening band to open for Gang of Four. And they said, well, if you can open for them at Hurrah, then you can open for them here too. So they put a third band on the bill.
So was it like a mini tour that you did with them then?
Just those three shows, yeah. And then we got back and I don't know, a month or so later, the Interview Magazine had a tiny little live review by Glenn O'Brien, two paragraphs of that show and Gang of Four. And that, then we all of a sudden had our, then we all of a sudden had like almost the only piece of press we really needed, Glenn O'Brien in Interview Magazine. And then that was good for everybody. So it's real easy moving forward.
Oh, I bet. Do you remember who the other band in Philly was that night that you played?
No, not at all. But Vanessa might know because she has done research and tried to, you know, figure stuff out about some of the past stuff. And, you know, sometimes if you really want to spend some time on Facebook and all that, a lot of this stuff has been figured out by looking at ads that people have kept, you know, strip ads and calendar books. Like somebody, God, I can't remember what. Oh yeah. So somewhere on Facebook, I saw one of the most amazing things. It's like a handwritten address or calendar type book. And I think it's maybe an entire month, but it's whatever. It's at least like a long, more than a, it's like a week or a month's worth of stuff all written in hand for TR3.
Oh, wow.
And Pylon is in there, you know, but like we're like playing on like whatever Wednesday, and then like the next day is Bush Tetris, and, you know, the day before. It's just like you read like the lineup of a band in just like a week during that era at a small club like TR3.
Yeah.
And it's just like, holy shit. We were right in there, right in the middle of this, you know, stuff was just happening like crazy all the time. And then plus back then we could go to New York, and I don't know why, but nobody seemed to mind if we played, you know, shows all around town on the same trip at different size clubs and different times of the week and all that. Everybody was pretty cool with it. Like, we tried to space them out. We'd check into the Iroquois Hotel and we'd, you know, maybe play a show in New York, and then we'd go play over in Trenton, and then maybe play at Maxwell's in Hoboken, and then maybe play another one in New York, and then drive to Boston and play, and then drive back to New York and play another show or something like that.
Oh, for the days before radius clauses. Going back, did you kind of perceive any differences that were going on in these places that you were, like the difference between like a New York or a Philly or a Boston scene back then?
It's hard for me to remember, you know, I just was so, all of it just seemed natural or something. Like, it just seemed like this was all meant, you know, I mean, not meant to be in a sense of destiny or fate, but just like, you know, you're just there and that's just the scene and we're a part of it. And, you know, we were headlining, you know, for most of what I'm talking about. Like, we didn't really have very many opening slots, you know, on and off throughout the band's career we did. But so, like, I don't know. I guess if you're headlining and people at these clubs want to hire you and people who pay to come in and see you want to come, that it just all seemed normal. About the only one that I can really even remember having a little bit of a different vibe, I think it was called the Underground, and it was in Boston in the ground floor of a dorm.
Oh, weird.
I think it used to be the laundromat, or I don't remember the story behind it, but, you know, like, that was still a big city compared to Athens, Georgia, but it was more of a collegey kind of, and some of the other places we played that were more of college gigs, like straight up playing at colleges, they had their own vibe. Honestly, I don't think we ever did any of that though until Pylon reformed in the late 80s. I don't remember that in the first era of Pylon that ended in 83, if colleges were really into a band like Pylon. But the Underground, you know, that kind of was. I don't know. I just enjoyed it all. I mean, we had some cities that just sort of innately seemed like their scene or their clubs were much more enthusiastic about Pylon and always super reliably supportive of the band.
Yeah, yeah.
So we ended up falling in love with certain cities or you know, felt like they had fallen in love with us kind of thing. More so than other cities, but in general, it was always good. We didn't have too many real flops. If there was a big flop, a lot of times it would be because there was some other circumstance that we weren't aware of, or the people who booked us didn't take into account, you know, competition from some other event, or I don't know what. But
how much interaction did Pylon have with the no wave scene that was kind of happening in New York or getting going in New York at the same time?
You know, none, because one of the things about being in the band is I don't remember ever going out to see music. You know, the only music
we were kind of busy.
Yeah. We were fairly booked and busy. I mean, we saw a lot of music, but it was other people's, you know, on the same bill with us probably. I guess that's another irony of being in a band is that I don't know, just back in Athens, I'd see a lot of bands, but I don't remember going to see bands very much. I mean, I remember going to see the Ramones at Irving Plaza when we were there for, you know, a show. I mean, to do our own shows. That's about the only one I can remember.
Oh, that would have been, I'm sure, like an unbelievable show. But you guys toured Canada, right? Like you did a little bit of touring up here.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, just, you know, the main one was just going up to Toronto. But then later on, or on different occasions, and definitely opening for Gang of Four, we played in Ottawa and Montreal and Toronto. So those are the only three cities we ever played, but I don't really remember how many times.
So from the sounds of it, you guys did do, you know, like touring early on, or was it more just kind of like driving directly for one show that you had booked? And you know, then driving back or just staying there for a couple of weeks and playing a few shows kind of in and around there? Or was it really like touring?
Yeah, no, we didn't. What we did, like, you know, initially, like when we played our first show in New York on that trip that included Philly and Boston, we made zero effort to try to find any other shows in between. And we hadn't even played in Atlanta yet. I mean, I had this like conviction that nobody was going to really welcome Pylon or understand it outside of like true like cultural capitals, you know. And the idea that we would go and play along the way up there just until we added DC, we didn't have any other place to stop, and we added DC fairly early on. So we would just drive up to the Northeast, and we would play like Providence and go up and play into Northampton and, you know, sometimes some other parts of New England. And then on other trips, we would make it over to the Midwest and play in Minnesota, in Minneapolis and Chicago and things like that. And then there were the big trips out west where we basically went straight out to California and then kind of straight back. So we never made it up to the Northwest, even though that scene was still, well, up until 83, I don't even know if it was a scene. I don't remember. But in Pylon number two, it seemed like we should have gone up there and we never made it. So it was usually just depended on which direction we were going in. I guess a longer tour might have included going to the Midwest and parts of Canada and the Northeast, but I don't really remember.
You did make it over to England though, right? And play some shows, at least there in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, that was all part of the plan when Armageddon partnered with DB Records to release Gyrate in the UK and also to license it elsewhere. So Armageddon was involved. They had a guy over in Atlanta, Peter Dyer, I believe Dyer was his last name. And so he was the person who, I guess, had the enthusiasm and the interest and worked with Danny on how to sort of split the band, you know, publishing or print, you know, publishing these albums elsewhere. But they also footed the bill for Pylon to go over there and do a bunch of shows in December of 1980. And it was great. They hired a flat for us to stay in and hired a tour manager who took care of us, you know, on a daily basis. And then they hired two guys or a company that had two employees that had a truck that carried the PA, because the PAs weren't provided by the venues in most cases. So they would get there before us and have already been setting up the PA before we got there. And we would mostly return to the flat every night. You know, we would just do a lot of out and back trips outside of working out of London to most of the venues. And then when we went a little further afield, I think only three times did we spend the night somewhere else, once in Blackpool, and then we went up and wherever Hugo Burnham lives, we stayed at his house. Maybe that was I can't remember, where is it, Gang of Four from Liverpool or oh, Leeds, right. Okay. And then I think we spent one night in Manchester with some American expats that were, I don't know, like big enough fans of music and stuff like that, that the club, you know, the club even set that up. So we had one or two shows that got canceled, you know, and we got to play at the Marquee in London. The Soft Boys were on the bill with us, which was a huge gift on their part, you know, to bring their heft to that bill so that our band could, you know, do okay at a club like that in London. We got really good press. All those magazines wrote about us every week, all those weeklies. And we did lots of interviews at pubs, and it was hilarious because, well, you know, the whole schedule over there, especially then, was like really early. I mean, the shows were all over by 11 p.m. And then at Hurrah, I mean, at Danceteria, you know, they didn't, the headliner didn't didn't play until like 3 a.m. and stuff. So the idea of getting up early to us, I mean, we were used to sleeping late and staying up till, you know, three or four. And so it was really weird to be over there and this tour guide would come and wake us up and say, come on, come on, you got an interview. We've got, you know, we got to get going. You got an interview in half an hour. And so we just barely get dressed and get in the car. And he would always arrange for all these interviews to take place at a pub at like 10 a.m. And he'd immediately go and get all of us a pint of beer. And so it was different and fun.
It's the little things that separate the cultures, you know, like drinking for breakfast.
Yeah, the food and the hours were the two main, you know, odd things about being over there.
When you started playing, you know, nationally and ultimately internationally, were there any bands that you kind of felt a strong kinship with or that you were part of like you know, part of a larger scene with at the time or that, you know, even that were kind of inspiring to you?
Well, I really would have to go back to the Gang of Four. I mean, they were an influence on us. I do think that's one example where the influence, you know, was more literal, like specific to certain parts about the songs. But that's easy to say because then when we played with them, it seemed to be a good fit. I mean, we still had like wildly different energies or sort of, you know, agendas. And then we ended up, you know, also becoming friends with them and really got brought along on some of their tours as much just for as much out of just friendship and just, you know, generosity as it was for the reasons of any kind of like absolute need for Pylon to be their opening band for any reason. So yeah, I would name them for sure. But wait, are we talking about bands that influenced Pylon or?
Well, yeah, certainly bands that influenced you, but also just bands that you felt part of a scene
Oh.
with, you know, like looking back, were there bands that you know, you would play with or you felt were kind of on the same.
Mission of Burma was another one, but a lot of this is just sort of like because we found ourselves, you know, in such similar circumstances. We ended up becoming good friends, like, or just having like nice, friendly, fun relationships with people like the other bands, like the Feelies, and then in Philly, we stayed with some of the girls that were in Head Cheese, And that band, I think they were art students. And that band, some of those people in that band are who started Book of Love. And then over in Boston, there was a girl, I think they were all girls. You may have to ask Vanessa who what the name of their band was. We used to stay with them too. And we didn't usually stay with people. We usually stayed in hotels. If we stayed with people, it was really just by choice, you know, because they invited us and it seemed like it would be more fun in a way to kind of get to know the place better and to know the people better. I can't remember Martha Sweetsoff's and Company's band name right now.
It's funny because you hear about Black Flag and DOA on the West Coast always talked about as this band that's kind of, you know, building the network that bands still, you know, kind of tap into today when they tour. And it's interesting that on the East Coast there's kind of like a parallel thing happening just about the exact same time frame too, with yourselves and all these bands kind of building that same sort of network.
Well, yeah, the network, you know, that we were helping to kind of learn and establish for ourselves, that was in large part just passed along to us by the B-52s as a recommendation of like which hotels to stay in and which clubs and here's who to call, here's the name of the booking agent or the that kind of thing. And so it became like just, you know, de rigueur for all of the other Athens bands that came after us, and they all had like basically the similar trajectory to go up and play in all those same shows. I mean, the same cities and venues for the most part. So it was this shared widely and became, you know, kind of the norm for all the people that we knew, at least from down here. It was one of the comforts of being on the road is that we got to know certain places so well, you know, by playing them over and over again because of the really just because of the staff. You know where to park and you know what's going on, you know the lay of the land. You're walking in the club for the third or fifth time to set up instead of that first time. And it just feels so good because you already know everything and you know the people. It felt like home, you know, to be at Hobo, to be at Maxwell's. And I know a lot of other bands feel this way. But Maxwell's, like, they just, it was so fun that they didn't have a backstage. They just had the cellar. And yeah, we just go kind of sit around and sit on top of empty kegs and things like that. And then they would feed us, you know, in the restaurant earlier in the day. And it's just so nice. And then the place would just be packed. And then in between sets or during dinner or whatever, there's a jukebox that's got our single on it. And oh God, it was always so fun and easy to be there.
Such a legendary club, you know, like just the bands that grace that stage from, you know, yourselves to right when it closed. Actually, it might be reopened now. But well, who knows what happens now. But yeah, like such a legendary room, like as with all these rooms that we're kind of talking about.
Yeah, definitely. It's surprising in many cases how long of a run, you know, so many places have had. Like the 40 Watt Club in Athens, we recorded something in there a week ago, a live stream. And I mean, it's fourth or fifth location for that particular business, but it's been in that location, you know, all the way back into the late 80s. And not only was I in Pylon and on the stage there a lot, but then I DJed there like an awful lot for 8 years, more than once a month for 8 years. And then I started like this art film, you know, projection night that was once a month at the 40 Watt Club that went on for years. And just all the times that I've been in that place because of stuff I was doing, not to mention going to see bands. And you know, I don't really get make it out to the 40 Watt Club very much anymore. And so we went in there the other night, about a week ago, yesterday, I think, and it was just so beautiful to see it. It was all clean and all lit up for the show, and it had been, and Barry, the owner, and you know, of course, was the one that came down there to let us in. And it was so bittersweet to be in there because she said this is the first time we've used this place since March 12th. And the floors, they just redone all their floors like right before March 12th, somewhere like close to that time. So the place is just beautiful and pristine, as if it was just being preserved for some future date to be used again. So yeah, it was really nice to be in there, but it just really struck me like how much that feels like home to me, even though I'm not a regular there these days, but I sure did spend a lot of time there.
So at the same time that all this stuff is going on with yourselves in Athens and this, you know, obviously the legendary Athens scene is kind of building, is there a parallel scene kind of happening in Atlanta too?
I think so. I mean, I don't really know much about it. We had a great time in Atlanta, though. I mean, once we finally started playing, I mean, we didn't wait that long. You know, we put Atlanta off for a little while. We weren't, you know, we when we were when, once it was once we were kind of cleared by everybody, like, you know, in some way, we went over there to play, and it was always good for us. I don't remember how many different venues we played because we mostly played at 688 Club at 688 Spring Street, and that's where most of the bands I ever went to see played, you know, unless they were bigger. And I mean, we had other opportunities to play over there, like playing outdoors at Piedmont Park and playing at this smaller venue in the front of the Fox Theater. And then we did get to open for Public Image Limited at the Agora. And we headlined at the Agora, which is a bigger theater type venue. But really, 688 is what I remember the most because we would play two nights in a row, to a Friday and Saturday when we got booked. And I also went over there to see a lot of bands, you know, because that was another cool part about it. Like Atlanta's, you know, far enough away that the two scenes don't blur together. But it's close enough that it's not that hard, you know, especially when you're young to drive over and go see a band. And I usually would have somewhere to stay. I could stay with family in Atlanta. If and so, you know, we just had again, just felt like home to us over there, especially at that club. But I don't really know that much about all the other bands, you know. I don't remember. I mean, there was a lot of bands that I really liked and that were in Athens all the time, like Guadalcanal Diary, but they ended up moving to Athens. And the Swimming Pool Cues, mostly just because of the, you know, the people involved that we've stayed in touch with them over all these years. But there are a lot of other bands that were more punk in nature for sure. I think they maybe they had more of a self-consciously punk scene in Atlanta.
It's so amazing that given the population, that Athens is the place that winds up with the much more legendary kind of storied scene, you know, not to diminish anything that came out of Atlanta in terms of bands, but it's just so fascinating that it was, you know, Athens over Atlanta.
Yeah, I know. And then also people do say that there was a rivalry or a less than, you know, a less than supportive relationship between the two, the scenes of the two cities. I don't know that we ever really felt that, but yeah, we had a really good run at 688. There's like a kind of a I mean, a pretty funny story where we just completely burned our bridges with them, though. We pissed them off to no end. And it's just so crazy because Pylon was always so well behaved. And it's just amazing that something that we did was so outrageous that they just said, you're never coming back here. In fact, they almost canceled our show. But so being art students and sort of, you know, a little precocious about it, we'd sit, you know, in backstage, and we just thought the graffiti was just, you know, disgusting. Like, it, what, we weren't amused by all the drawings of dicks and things like that. And early on, we were just resolved, like, we are not adding our name to any of this. You know, if we ever get any stickers made, we are not putting them on the toilet, or, you know, that's just not the way we do it, right? And so we concocted this idea, like, our graffiti, just to backtrack, I had this like thing that was supposed to sound like a gang called the Scrapes, you know, and that was the name of the gang. This is also stupid, but is when we were in art school, and what the Scrapes would do, because I was a Boy Scout and an Eagle Scout, we would go downtown to some closed up, you know, business whose windows had just been taped up, like flyered over, like, you know, 14 layers. And we'd peel it all off and bring buckets of soapy water and step ladders and wore gloves and had razor blades and everything. And we cleaned these windows, you know, of all of the posters. And we'd put like a tiny, tiny little sign down in the corner that said something like, this clean window provided to you by the Scrapes, you know. So we did something like that at 6-8-8, like, because we'd sit, when we were touring, we'd be like, yeah, if we were ever going to do graffiti, you know what our graffiti would be? We would just paint the damn walls and make them all, like, you know, brand new again. Well, we always used to talk about it, but of course we never did it. So one time we were in Atlanta and we were playing that two nights, and we were at 6-8-8 on Friday night. And we started talking about it again. And then one of us is like, well, damn it, we always say this, but we never do it. This time, let's do it. So we made a plan. And I think Vanessa and I went to Sears the next day, or me and somebody, and we bought drop cloths and paint rollers and rolling pans and brushes and a very nice, like, robin's egg blue or baby blue paint. And we came back all determined. We smuggled it all in because they had to walk right by the front door, come in the front door and go right by the office. And we go in there and we pulled, and the place is big. And we pulled all the furniture away from the walls and put down drop cloths. And we just madly start going along, like somebody's like cutting in up near the ceiling, and somebody's cutting in down by the baseboards. And then we're starting to roll it. And that every time we had a guest that wanted to come in, they'd send them around to the dressing room and they'd knock on the door and it was locked. And they'd say, Hey, this is Tony. You have a guest out here. And we're like, okay, we'll be there in a sec. Thanks. And so we'd wait till he walked away and we'd let somebody in. And this happened like one too many times. And he finally said, open this door. What is going on in there? And so we finally had to let him in. And we had painted like two walls and he lost it. This was equivalent to him of us painting the Mona Lisa baby blue. I mean, just absolutely violated his club, his, you know, infrastructure, his dressing room. He owned the damn place. I mean, he was a partner, but he, you know, he got right up in each of our faces and yelled at each of us, you know, individually for quite a while. And he said, you know, like, what if I had snuck into your house and painted your living room monkey shit brown, you know, and then I'd say something stupid, something smart, like, well, we didn't use monkey shit brown. We used a really nice baby blue, you know, and he just like, so if it had been up to him, we would not have performed that night. the place was packed, right? His partner, Steve May, talked him out of that. But it was clear when we settled up that night that we were not ever going to be welcome back. So.
Well, Michael, please know if you ever want to come back here and do a part two, you are always welcome back.
Okay, well, I hope you have a nice 3-hour slot for your show, because by the time you finish talking to Vanessa, you'll have way too much. But good luck with it. I look forward to hearing it.
Thank you, Michael, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, we're going to need another 3-hour slot because Michael will be back at some point for a part two down the line. But we will be back in a short couple blinks of the eye with Vanessa from Pylon. And as I said before, off the top, very different episodes. But yeah, fantastic episodes. Okay, that is it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect the lives of trans people. Huge election stuff. Let's just see how this all goes. In the U.S., of course, huge election stuff happening all over the world. But, you know, get involved. Still get involved. Sign up. Donate money if you can. Show up. It still goes on, you know. Unfortunately, this stuff just doesn't end after one election. In fact, it's more important than ever that people still, you know, get involved in any way that they can and help fight fascism, help, you know, this unfortunately doesn't mean it's over. So we got to keep fighting on. Also, speaking of fighting on, remember to fight on and sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you're not going to need them. And you know, what a better way to kind of like give to people after the fact. You know, my uncle had a heart transplant and is alive now and is living his life. And, you know, it's amazing to watch that happen. And so I really can't stress that enough. If you can, please sign your organ donor cards because, you know, as I said, you're not going to need them when they come looking for them. I got to cheer this thing up because that's pretty heavy to leave you on. So go out there and make your own culture. Anyone can do this stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine, make art, do something. Just create, get yourself, you know, some sort of creative therapy going. I find it really helps me. You know, when I get down, I draw a little bit and I don't know, it doesn't make it go away, but it helps me kind of work through it a little bit, I find. So, you know, do something, create culture and, wear a mask, stay safe. And I love you. And yeah, see you on the other side. I mean, next episode, which is, you know, that sounds really bleak. Oh man, we're ending on a real downer on that one. No, we will see you for the amazing Vanessa episode. That is the next thing we will talk. Next time we will talk. Love you. Bye.